Good evening, boys and ghouls, freaks, perverts, and weirdos, and all points in between. I'm your host, Johnny Zombie, and this is the Flypaper Dungeon, a somewhat weekly podcast dedicated to horror, the macabre, and all things icky, disgusting, and, well, freaky. So this week, I decided to do something a little different. As some of you may know, today is my birthday, June 6th, although by the time this episode's posted, it might be a day or two after. So I decided to do something a little different instead of covering a topic or specific film. Originally, I was going to cover the Frankenstein films that James Whale had directed, which I will do later on this month. But as for today, I decided to do something a little different. I'm going to talk about the 80s. It came from the 80s. Now, I was born in 1979, but I grew up as a kid in the 1980s. So I'm just going to talk about some of the things I liked as a kid, some of the TV shows and movies I watched. Granted, if I were to list all the movies I watched in the 80s, or all the movies that came out during the 1980s, we'd be here forever. There just wouldn't be enough time for me to discuss it. So I'm just going to mention a few highlights, a few things that were important to me as a kid, growing up in the 1980s, since after all, this week is my, well, today is the day of my birth, so just something a little personal and topical, I guess you could say, based upon the day. So that is coming right up. First off, I have a couple of, well, not a couple, but an obituary to read, and that is James Arness. Best known for playing Marshall Dillon on Gunsmoke. He was 88 years old. He was the older brother of Peter Graves. And also, he was the title character in Howard Hawks' The Thing from Another World, which later on was the basis for John Carpenter's The Thing. So, James Arness, dead at age 88 after a very long career in film and in television. Not the least of which was Gunsmoke, which ran from 1953, I believe it was, until 1974. One of the longest-running TV series of all time. In fact, it was the longest-running television series in American TV history until Law & Order tied it. So, we mourn the passing of James Arness, a legend and one of the last true cowboys. In addition to being my birthday on June 6th, it is also the birthday of Robert Englund, better known as Freddy Krueger. And as listeners of this show will know, I am quite the fan of Mr. Englund and Mr. Krueger as well. Although I'm not a huge fan of slasher films, I do enjoy the Nightmare on Elm Street films. And actually my favorite Robert Englund role is his role in The Phantom of the Opera. I actually feel that his version of The Phantom of the Opera is one of the best versions ever made of that story, and that's actually my favorite version of Phantom of the Opera. So, wishing Robert Englund a happy birthday. He is 64 years old today. And I will post a link to his website, which is simply robertenglund.com, and post a photo of him as well. Oh, and by the way, he did an interview about a year and a half ago, with Horror Etc. Very good interview. It's a solid hour of a conversation with Robert Englund. It was more like an informal conversation rather than a straightforward interview. Very well done.
and he was very relaxed and very pleasant and very warm during the interview. Seems like an incredibly nice guy. I highly recommend checking out that interview. It's available either through iTunes, just search for Horror, etc., HORROR ETC, or go to their website, which is HorrorEtc.com, and you can download it from there as well. England has had quite a long career, since 1974, and which is interesting to note is that England is one of only two actors to play a horror character 8 consecutive times, the other being Doug Bradley, who played Pinhead in the Hellraiser films. Now, what's also of interest to note is that up until the recent remake of A Nightmare on Elm Street, Robert Englund was the only actor to play Freddy Krueger. He played Freddy Krueger in the TV series Freddy's Nightmares as well. And he's been in, of course, multiple horror films and TV series, not the least of which was V, the original V miniseries, back in the early 80s, just a year before he did Freddy Krueger in 1984. And I remember watching him in those movies, in that television series. And, you know, what a complete reversal it was when he played Freddy Krueger. You know, he's one of those actors, you could put him up there with Sir Christopher Lee and Peter Cushing and Vincent Price. He's one of the very few actors alive today, him and Tobin Bell and Doug Bradley, and Sir Christopher Lee, that are synonymous with the horror genre, and that have played memorable, iconic characters. And if you were to read through Robert Englund's CV here, you'd be here for several days. I mean, you know, movies he did, TV shows that he did, movies that he's going to do, movies that he's even, you know, directed as well. I mean, most recently, he's in the video game Call of the Dead, you know, which features George A. Romero, you know, as a character. And, you know, Danny Trejo from Machete, Sarah Michelle Gellar, you know, from Buffy, essentially performing themselves, you know, playing characters based upon themselves. You know, just the list is, you know, phenomenal, you know, of movies that he's been in. I would highly recommend, of course, the original Nightmare on Elm Street, his version of Phantom of the Opera, I think it's amazing. Behind the Mask, The Rise of Leslie Vernon, that's a cool movie that I would like to see more people get into. He plays a character based on Dr. Sam Loomis, kind of a spoof on Halloween and the slasher films. Jack Brooks' Monster Slayer, which is a very funny movie. It's sort of a Shaun of the Dead type spoof, and I wish more people would pick up on it. And the list just goes on and on. You know, there's so many great things that he's done, both in and out of the horror genre, and he's made a whole career out of it. You know, we would just be here for days, you know, listing everything that he's been in. So, happy birthday to Mr. Robert Englund, 64 years old today. Oh, and of interest to note, I just picked this up as a little bit of trivia. He's married to a woman named Nancy Booth.
I'm your boyfriend now, Nancy!
Just thought that was kind of, interesting. So, today is also the day that the Battle of D-Day had occurred. A battle that my paternal grandfather had fought at, and he was actually a POW and was awarded the Bronze Star and the Purple Heart. So those of you that have veterans in your family, thank them for their service on this day. And if you know somebody who had passed away who was in the service, plant a flag on their grave, or just keep them in your prayers and in your thoughts today. Today was a historic occasion in 1944, in which the largest land invasion ever spearheaded the fall of the Third Reich, and the end of World War II, or what was to eventually become the end of World War II. And it was by good luck and providence that the GIs made it onto the beach in those Higgins boats and brought the Third Reich to its knees. So, a special thank you to all the service people out there who have served in the past and are still serving today. Your sacrifice and your hard work is appreciated. So, up next, it came from the 80s.
Thank you.
some more Roy Guru with More Than Reality, which can be found on archive.org and downloaded for free. Part of his EP, My Little Kingdom. All the music on that EP is very reminiscent of the music in Nintendo games. And I mean that as a compliment. He really recreates video game music perfectly. It's very evocative of that whole era. You could listen to this music while playing video games, whether it's old Atari or old Nintendo games. Just perfect. Just absolute perfect emulation. There was a certain beauty to some of that music. Like, the theme from Double Dragon is absolutely beautiful. Of course, Super Mario Brothers, you know, gorgeous music there. The music to Castlevania is, I believe, the best video game music ever made. For Nintendo or anything else. So, what were the 1980s? Well, damned if I know. I only grew up during that time period. The 80s were a very interesting time. You had a cross-section of extreme haves like Donald Trump and the have-nots, who were benefited by concerts like Live Aid and Farm Aid and the like, and in fact Farm Aid is still going on, which John Mellencamp once said is kind of a good thing because we've kept it going. It's kind of a bad thing because we have to keep doing it. Because enough people out there need the help. The 1980s were also a time period of... Well, it was a very youth-oriented time period. Now, I may be stumbling a bit here, but it's hard to encapsulate a decade in a few words or in a single episode. It was a very youth-oriented time period, especially oriented towards children and teenagers. This was the era of John Hughes and movies like Weird Science and The Breakfast Club. It was also an era in which we saw The Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi and E.T. We also saw some great horror movies being made during this time period like Fright Night and The Lost Boys. And we also saw continuations of franchises like Friday the 13th. And of course, we saw another continuous franchise, A Nightmare on Elm Street, and the birth of Freddy Krueger in 1984. We saw Atari kind of on its last legs during this decade, and the birth of Nintendo and Sega, and the rivalry that ensued between the two of them. So there were a lot of social changes during the 1980s, whether it be in fashion, such as the members-only jacket, and those ridiculous shades that people wore, those sunglasses that literally looked like a pair of Venetian blinds. I always thought those looked stupid. And then, of course, we had the great Wayfarer sunglasses, which still look awesome. Or whether it was social changes in the music, and that sort of synth-pop music that came about by bands like the Eurythmics and Human League and New Order, which had just risen from the remains of Joy Division, or bands like U2, and the new wave of British heavy metal, which actually began in the 70s, but really reached its peak in the 1980s, with Motorhead, Lemmy, God himself, and Iron Maiden and Judas Priest, and then America's answer to that with bands like Metallica and Pantera. We also had hair metal back then, with Motley Crue and Poison and Cinderella. We also had the rise of Michael Jackson. Again, began in the late 70s with Jackson 5, but really hit his stride as a solo artist, I feel. The rise of Madonna. The rise of Van Halen and Bon Jovi. We saw a lot of classic rock acts coming back, like the Rolling Stones and The Who. And we saw, unfortunately, the death of John Lennon as well. 1980s. But we saw some kick-ass movies, too, like Aliens, and the aforementioned Return of the Jedi and Empire Strikes Back, and Conan the Barbarian, and a renewed interest in Robert E. Howard, and a renewed interest in H.P. Lovecraft as well, in the 1980s, helped in no small part by Stuart Gordon's adaptation, very loose adaptation, of Reanimator, and by Dan O'Bannon's adaptation of From the Beyond. So, we saw a lot of different... Oh, and Stephen King, of course. Granted, late 70s started to... or Carrie was published in the late 70s, but really hit his stride in the 1980s and became a massive celebrity during that time period. And the rise of Clive Barker and Anne Rice as well. Interview with a Vampire was published in 1979, now that I recall. And Clive Barker would make his entree into the horror genre with Hellraiser in 1988. The 80s could be a very class-conscious time period. But for me as a child, it was a very youth-oriented time period. It was a great time to be a kid, despite, you know, problems at home and other little upheavals at school and here and there. I still would not want to be a kid in any other time period. This was the era of G.I. Joe and Transformers, Nintendo, the sort of death knell of Atari was going to be sounded soon, but hey, you know, it's a fair cop. You know, we still had Atari during this era. Nintendo came along and changed the game forever, and completely cleaned everybody's clock as well, and brought us Super Mario Brothers and Donkey Kong. Well, those had been around before Nintendo had its own NES console. They had been in arcades, and Donkey Kong had been on the Atari, but it was an early effort from Nintendo and the legendary Shigeru Miyamoto. So, what was I watching in the 1980s? What was I experiencing as a kid? Well, experiencing through television, I should say. I think my earliest TV memories and earliest movie and media memories revolve around Nickelodeon. Well, actually, before then, it was the Raiders of the Lost Ark, watching that in the theater when I was a little kid, and seeing that and remembering it vividly and acting out parts of it, and then watching it on video at home. But you can't do that on television. Was a children's show that was produced in Canada, began in 1979, ended in the early 90s, if I do recall. And it was a sketch show, a sketch variety show, that I'd watched as a child, and absolutely loved. I thought it was one of the funniest things I'd ever seen. Typically, they would do sketches that were about teenagers, you know, and adolescents and what they went through, and each episode would have a different topic. And there were common sketches that would carry on into different shows, so it was almost like they had this environment that was built up. Like, for example, they would go to eat at Barf's Burgers, this burger joint, run by this guy named Barf. And Barf was this disgusting, you know, disheveled guy, and he would put really disgusting, really horrific things in his burgers. And the punchline at the end of each sketch involving Barf's Burgers would be, "What do you think's in the burgers?" Like, for example, he had Big Bird in the burgers one time, and I'll never forget this. They had a Big Bird corpse in a shopping cart with X's over its eyes. And they had a sketch where it was a firing squad, where a kid would try to outwit the commandant of the firing squad, and sometimes they would outwit him, and he would wind up getting shot. There was no blood. You would just hear the sound effect of guns being fired, and he would fall over dead, and do it really silly and really over the top. They had a torture chamber where he was kind of like an SS guard, and he would torture people, and it was the same actor that played all of those roles. Les Lye was his name. And he also played the dad in a series of sketches where it would be like a family, and he was the father of this dysfunctional family, and he always wore clothes that were ripped up and that were in rags, and he would talk like this, and talk like Torgo in Manos the Hands of Fate, actually. And he would smoke a cigar. He would smoke a cigar on set in front of the kids. Something you wouldn't get today. You literally could not do that on television today. And he also played the character of Ross, who was sort of the line producer of the show as well. And the host of the show was a young actress named Christine McGlade, who who I thought was absolutely adorable, absolutely beautiful back then, and she still works in Canadian television now. She's largely a producer and writer now, and she was the head of the CBC's division of children's programming most recently. And she herself is a mom and has kids. Now, one of the sad things about You Can't Do That on Television is that there's no modern equivalent of it today. Nickelodeon had a show called All That in the 90s, but wasn't quite the same thing. Wasn't quite as outrageous. Another sad thing, too, is that it's not available on DVD. It is available via bootleg. There are bootlegs of VHS tapes and bootleg DVDs that fans of the show have made and traded amongst each other. You might be able to find some on eBay. or another sites like it. I'm not saying you can, I'm just saying you might be able to. And I noticed that somebody did post videos of it to YouTube, which is where I've been able to find it and rewatch episodes of it. And I think it's very odd that it's not available on DVD. Now, Christine McGlade had commented that it was going to be made available on DVD, and that there were plans to interview the original cast members for bonus features and the like, but the deal fell through. Shout Factory was going to release it on DVD, but it wound up not happening simply because Viacom, the parent company that owns Nickelodeon and MTV, they were bought out by somebody else, and, you know, due to upheavals and changes in management, they just decided not to go ahead with it. The show is owned by Carlton Television, though. It's not owned by Nickelodeon. And I just hope that someday this gets resolved and it does get released on DVD. And someday soon. There are fans of the show that have traded these tapes for years, so there is a demand for it. It's not that it wouldn't make money, it would. And in fact, this is where Nickelodeon gets the slime from. Their trademark slime comes from You Can't Do That on Television. If a character in a sketch said, I don't know, slime would be dumped on them from the ceiling, just seemingly out of nowhere. And the slime was made from oatmeal and food coloring. There's a couple of different recipes for it, and at one point, Christine McGlade actually wound up wearing a wig on days that she would have slime dumped on her, because washing that stuff out of her hair, you know, really frizzled her hair a bit. So she would wear a wig where she could just take the wig off, just kind of dry herself off, and that would be the end of it. They would also dump water on people, and in some sketches they would dump both. If you mentioned water in a sentence, no matter what way you said it, water would be dumped on you from the ceiling. And if an actor got slime dumped on them, they could also say, well, water, and then water would come down and wash them off. This was a staple of Saturday mornings and Saturday afternoons and weekday afternoons. I would come home from school, and this would be on Nickelodeon. Saturday nights, it would be on Nickelodeon, too. Usually, like Count Duckula and Danger Mouse would be on afterwards as well. So this was a staple of my childhood. And I think it's a real shame that it's not on DVD yet. And there are fans of the show. I've seen interviews with cast members now on YouTube, and they've said that they know people who are fans of the show that will share this with their kids and want to share it with their kids, but have only been able to find bootleg videos, and they themselves have not been able to really share it with their kids if they can't track down these bootlegs. Or, you know, they find it online on sites like YouTube and whatever have you, and technically it's illegal to post them there, but how else can anybody see this? You know, it's not available on video anywhere. So unless somebody takes the risk and posts them on YouTube or whatever have you, there's no other way to see them. So hopefully this will be resolved and it'll eventually be made available on DVD. Or made available to buy on download, legally, through like iTunes or whatever have you.
Welcome to S-Mart. This week, we have the Johnny Zombie and Friends play set. Yes, you too can manipulate your favorite horror host in his dungeon of tantalizing, teasing, taunting terrors. Deep within the dungeon, there's an assortment of whips and chains, Iron Maidens, and the infamous Rack. And what magnificent rack it is. Johnny Zombie comes with an assortment of victims. Redheads, brunettes, blondes, bottled, bleached, or real. All are equal in his eye. And all shall receive the sting of his riding crop. And deep within the dungeon is the hunchback in the cage. Who gets the licorice or he gets the hose? Also available, the Samurai Dillon Katana Blade. So sharp, it'll cut through school buses. You can tell it's high quality. It's marked on the hilt the number of men it sliced through. No two blades are alike. This one in particular has been known to cut through a buffalo in one solid swipe. Also available at S-Mart this week, the new revised Necronomicon, new international version. Feast your eyes upon this new translation of the occult classic, now with easier to pronounce Vrulian chants. Never again will you have difficulty pronouncing Cthulhu Fatargan or In Realm Ye, Cthulhu Lies Dead Dreaming in the original tongue. We also have a special one, Freddy Krueger Makeup Kits. Yes. Learn to conceal those crispy burn marks and those deep pockmarked pits. That way your victims won't know you're Freddy until you're really close. Also, the Krueger Glove Sharpening Kit. Make sure to kill them on the first swipe. Never again will they run away and give you a problem. Also, the Cthulhu Idol Waxing Kit. Make sure your idol is free of dust and mold and dirt, so that when the Great Ancient One returns, you can greet him with a nice, shiny Cthulhu idol. All that and more at S-Mart. It's always a red light special at S-Mart. Remember, shop smart. Shop S.
Yes, I did that off the top of my head. That was completely improvised. I had not scripted that before. Normally, whenever I do little spoofs like that, I write them out before, but the mood struck me, so I just did an S-Mart spoof. Okay, next up, Danger Mouse. Now, Danger Mouse was produced by Thames Television in Britain. David Jason voiced Danger Mouse. And I talked about Count Duckula before in the Saturday morning cartoon show episode, so I'm just going to talk very briefly about it here. Danger Mouse was kind of a James Bond spoof. Danger Mouse lived at 221B Baker Street, just under where Sherlock Holmes had lived. Literally, he lived, like, in the subterranean lair underneath 221B Baker Street. It was accessible next to a red mailbox. The kind they have in Britain. And Danger Mouse had this flying Danger Mouse mobile car that he would fly around in. And he had a trusty sidekick named Penfold, who was sort of the comic relief, kind of the bumbling sort, but very likable. And his arch nemesis was Silas Greenback, this anthropomorphic frog that would talk like this. And his evil henchman, Stiletto, who was a crow wearing a trench coat and a fedora. And Silas had this little caterpillar that he would pet named Nero, who was very cat-like. And Duckula was originally introduced as a villain in the series. It's been kind of retconned that the reason why he's a nice guy in the series, and he's a bad guy in, or excuse me, a nice guy in his own series, and a bad guy in Danger Mouse, was that in Danger Mouse, this was one of the previous incarnations of Duckula. Duckula came from a long line of vampire ducks who were evil, but when Count Duckula was resurrected, Ketchup was substituted for blood by accident in the resurrection ceremony. And as a result, he was brought back as a vegetarian and was completely harmless and wouldn't hurt a fly. And he was more interested in trying to be a celebrity or in, just having a good time rather than actually biting anyone. So unlike Edward Cullen, he was actually kind of fun. He wasn't mopey, not a mopey vampire, but a funny vampire. And I absolutely loved Count Dracula and Danger Mouse, so I talked at length about Dracula and the Saturday morning cartoon show episode, so I'm just going to mention it very briefly here. Dracula was also voiced by David Jason. Oh, and Danger Mouse's superior was Colonel K, a sort of spoof on M in the James Bond movies. Next up, Nintendo. Nintendo began as a card-playing company in the late 19th century. They eventually worked their way into pinball games, and then eventually video games. And I remember the first Nintendo I ever played. Actually, I still have it. I still own my Nintendo. It was Christmas Day of 87. Yes, it was Christmas Day of 87 when we got it. And I'll never forget that, just playing Super Mario Brothers and Ghosts and Goblins and 3D World Runner and all these other classic games. I still have all the games. I have the system itself. I still have my original NES, my original Game Boy, which I got in 1989, I believe it was, and all the games for that. And on occasion, I still play them. I even have a Nintendo DS that I whip out on occasion, and a Game Boy Advance. You know, I've always been a Nintendo man myself. I don't have a Wii, but so I cannot Wii. I don't have a Wii. But yeah, I've always enjoyed Nintendo ever since I was a kid, and sometimes I get a little nostalgic for those old games, but I'll go online and play them on emulators and such, or I'll hook up the old system and play it. But I'm a little leery of doing that because I'm sentimental and, you know, I want to keep it preserved. But yes, Nintendo, both a source of joy and frustration for me as a kid. But I think more joy than frustration, especially in retrospect. I've never been a great video game player. I'm good at certain games. There are some games for the Nintendo that just out of sheer stubbornness and practice and interest I got really good at and was able to complete. And there's some games for Game Boy I was able to complete. Some games I've played online that I've been able to complete. So, I'm a fair video game player. You know, if it's a game that I really like and I show a lot of interest in, I will eventually break through. Just out of sheer stubbornness, I'll eventually win it. You know, I think I'm a fair video game player. Not a wizard, but I'm not bad. You know, and I've gotten better as I've gotten older. Next up, at number 5, the iconic Ghostbusters. I have not done a Ghostbusters episode yet. At some time, I will, probably in October. But I absolutely loved Ghostbusters when I was a kid, and still do. I used to watch the real Ghostbusters when I was a kid, and of course the movies, you know, I'd watched several times and had the toys. I've talked about this extensively on the Saturday Morning Cartoon Show episode. And I don't know what else I could add more to it other than to do an entire episode about Ghostbusters, which I will do at some point. At number 6, Fright Night. The original classic Fright Night starring Roddy McDowall, William Ragsdale, Amanda Bierce, Stephen Jeffries, and Chris Sarandon. How could you remake this film? You can't. You cannot remake it. And I was actually very angry when I heard they were going to remake it. And now that I've seen the previews for it, I know that I have every reason to be angry. The previews just look awful. They look awful. I don't want to spoil anything for anybody, but go and seek out the trailer for the new Fright Night. It just looks god-awful. Complete contradiction of the original film. Now, I'll discuss it at a later date when I do an episode about Fright Night. I will do an episode about the original Fright Night, but I'm disgusted with the idea that they did a remake. But the original Fright Night, to me, is one of the best vampire movies I've ever seen. If anybody wants to complain about it, or if they feel it's not dark enough, that's fine, you know, to each their own. But for me, it's a classic vampire film. It's very reminiscent of the Hammer films in a way, especially since Roddy McDowall plays a character named Peter Vincent, named for both Peter Cushing and Vincent Price. And there are scenes where we see clips of movies that Peter Vincent was in, and in those movies, he's playing a Peter Cushing-style character, and he's hammering stakes in the vampires' chests and that sort of thing, and Peter Vincent is a horror movie host. Brewster is a young fan of the Fright Night creature feature show, where these horror movies are broadcast, hosted by Peter Vincent. And Charlie begins to suspect that his neighbor is a vampire. And lo and behold, his neighbor is a vampire, played by Chris Sarandon. Now, prior to this, Sarandon had played in Dog Day Afternoon. He was Al Pacino's lover in Dog Day Afternoon. And he had been in a movie called Lipstick with Margot Hemingway and Mariel Hemingway, where he played this absolutely vicious rapist. I saw that movie recently, and in fact, I saw that movie a long time ago, but I'd forgotten I'd seen it, and it wasn't until I rewatched it recently that I remembered actually having seen it. The ending looked really familiar to me, and when I saw that ending, it just came back to memory. It's a horrific film. I mean, you know, it's about the sexual assault of two young women who in real life were sisters, the Hemingway sisters, and he plays their rapist in the film. So playing a bad guy is no strange territory to Chris Sarandon. But the bad guy roles that we associate him with are in Fright Night, as Dandridge the Vampire, and Evil Prince Humperdinck in The Princess Bride. And anytime I see him in a movie, I think of Fright Night, and I think of The Princess Bride. And Evil Prince Humperdinck is in some ways reminiscent of Dandridge the Vampire in Fright Night. He also played in Child's Play. I was going to say Chucky, but Child's Play. And in that movie, he was the hero. He was the cop that was after Brad Dourif, his character, who became Chucky. And he winds up saving the day. So for once in his career, he played a good guy. But pretty much he's played villains his entire career and done a great job playing villains. William Ragsdale, who played Charlie, went on to play on a show called Herman's Head, a comedy that was on Fox in the 90s. He hasn't had a hugely successful career, which kind of surprises me, but he was great in Fright Night, and he was great on Herman's Head. Amanda Bierce went on to also star on a Fox show. She played Marcy on Married with Children. Stephen Jeffries was in 976 Evil, which was directed by Robert Englund, so he's had somewhat of a successful career in horror. He also did, I'll be honest with you, he's done gay porn films as well. But, hey, to each their own, you know, I don't judge here if you do porn. I will excuse it, you know. I've got no beef with people who do porn. But, yeah, he has done porn films in recent years, and then eventually went back to doing horror films and plays. And Jeffries will always be known as Evil Ed in Fright Night, who issued the iconic lines, "You're so cool, Brewster! Johnny's dinner is in the oven!" And lines like that. He's hysterical in this film. And it's one of those iconic films that if you were a kid in the 1980s, you had to see this film. You had to grow up watching this film. It was almost a rite of passage. And if you haven't seen Fright Night, the original Fright Night, you're missing out. You need to catch up with it. I would also like to add a movie called The Woman in White, which is a great movie starring Lucas Haas. I need to talk about that when I do ghost stories at some point, or films about ghosts, and my favorite ghost films. But it's just an absolutely beautiful film that has become a cult classic. It hasn't gotten a whole lot of attention, which really, really surprises me. I think in recent years it's been somewhat rediscovered. But I have to do a top 10 ghost films at some point, and that has to be one of them. Next up, G.I. Joe. I was a huge fan of G.I. Joe. I wore combat fatigues. I had a big metal canister that I kept all my G.I. Joes in. I had an assortment of vehicles that I kept underneath the kitchen counter, actually. There was a cabinet that I kept them in. And I also had a closet. We had an entranceway in the house I grew up in. And I had, like, books on the top shelf, and then some action figures, and then some G.I. Joe vehicles in there as well. An assortment of other action figures, like He-Man and stuff like that. But yes, I had an assortment of G.I. Joes, and would enact these elaborate battles with them, and science fiction stories with them as well, and these just huge action movie battle sequences. I mean, this was the era of Schwarzenegger, and I was a huge fan of Schwarzenegger in the 1980s, you know, with the Terminator and Commando and stuff like that, and his iconic line of "I'll be back," you know. Regardless of what may have been maybe happening to him now, you know, I still think that Schwarzenegger is an important action star, and I was just a huge fan of him back in the day, and still am. And you know, for me, G.I. Joe was it. You know, they were action heroes. There was science fiction added to it. There was Indiana Jones style action to it. So I was just a huge, huge fan of G.I. Joe, and that's something that, again, I could do an entire episode about. And number 8. Weird Science, which I recently revisited, and I have to say, it has held up tremendously well. It's still just as funny now as it was back in the day, and this is one of those movies that I watched repeatedly as a kid, and there was a period where I hadn't seen it for a very long time, and so I revisited it about a year ago, and I'd forgotten how funny it was, and the scene where Anthony Michael Hall is trying to talk like a streetwise African-American, when they take him to the bar, when Kelly LeBrock takes him to the dive bar, it's absolutely hysterical. I'd forgotten how funny he was when his character is drunk. And I'd forgotten absolutely, you know, other scenes that were just hilarious. I do remember the scene where Bill Paxton gets turned into a Jabba the Hutt creature. How funny that is. And Kelly LeBrock threatens him. She says, "You're lucky I didn't give you elephant balls." And he played a character that was very reminiscent of Hudson, his character in Aliens. He plays a character who was a Marine as well in Weird Science, so it was just serendipitous, you know, that he played that kind of character before he did Aliens, actually.
From my heart and from my hand, why don't people understand my intention?
So a little excerpt from Weird Science by Oingo Boingo, the theme song for John Hughes' Weird Science. So at number 9, Saturday Morning Cartoons. I did a whole episode about this, and at some point I need to do another episode. There's always more. There's always more Saturday Morning Cartoons. There's always more that can be said about Saturday morning in the 1980s. And at some point, I will do like a top 10, like on toys and such, which brings me to number 10. Oh, and before I go to number 10, I just want to add that I did do an episode about Saturday morning cartoon shows of the 1980s that Dylan and I both talked about. And that episode, you would have to search in the archives. It was, I believe, June of last year. When I did that episode. And speaking of which, on the 26th of this month, it'll be the one-year anniversary of the Flypaper Dungeon. But yes, that episode, Saturday Morning Cartoon Shows of the 1980s, it's one of the most popular episodes that I had done, and Dylan co-hosted with me on that episode, too. And it's an episode that I really enjoy and that I'm very proud of, so I highly recommend people check it out. It's, I believe, about an hour long, if I'm not mistaken. And if you just type into the search box in the upper left-hand corner, you can find it. You can also go through the archives. It's pretty easy to find. I believe it was the 7th episode that we recorded, I think. So it's among that crop of, like, the first few episodes. I might actually post a link to it in the show notes for today. But it's an episode that I really enjoyed doing, and it was a lot of fun to do. Okay, at number 10, and I'm just going to kind of rush through this a little bit. Not that I'm pressed for time, but I'm trying to keep this episode under an hour here. Number 10, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. Again, this is a topic that deserves an episode unto itself. And this list is kind of a top 10 of the 1980s. There are more movies, more TV shows I could have talked about. And at some point I will need to do like a top 10 children's movies of the 1980s, top 10 horror movies or sci-fi movies, etc. Which I think is an easier way to talk about subjects than to just simply talk about all of the films within a subgenre. But suffice to say, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, huge influence on me as a kid. Eastman and Laird created them in the 1980s. They were an underground cult classic phenomena that eventually broke through to the mainstream, became a hugely successful, excuse me, comic book series, cartoon series, movie series, toy line, etc. You name it. I had TMNT t-shirts, I had the toys, in fact, I still have the comic books, I don't have the t-shirts, and unfortunately I don't have the toys anymore, I wish I still did. But I have the comic books, a few of the graphic novels, you can even read back issues online through the TMNT website, which I did a while back, and I recently reread some of the graphic novels. And I'm very much surprised and delighted that they've held up tremendously well. They're still a hoot to read, and the artwork is just fantastic, illustrated by both Eastman and Laird, trading off on illustration jobs, and written by them as well, or at least initially the series was written by them. Fantastic stuff. And for those of you that only think of TMNT as the children's cartoon from the 80s, I highly recommend you check out the comic book. It's very different. It's more for grown-ups, it's more adult, and I would highly recommend that readers check out the comic book. So, what next? Well, I think I am going to play a bit more music, and then come back with a final thought and some congratulations to hand out.
Presenting a remix by Brawny. Disco.
If New Order were to score a Castlevania game, that is what it would sound like. Italian Disco Remix from OC Remix. Very 1980s, very 80s sound to it, very 80s feel. There are whole shows out there that are dedicated completely to the 1980s, like Branded in the 80s. I would have to do a search and find more of them. But there are whole shows that are dedicated to them, and to different topics from the 1980s. Some are dedicated just to the cartoons, some to video games, some to the movies, some are dedicated to the fashion. The fashion was very scary in the 1980s, let me tell you. But that's a topic unto itself. And in fact, I have a little personal story about that. A while ago, at the place I was working at, we had members-only jackets at the store I used to work at, which shall remain nameless. But I'm pretty sure they still sell members-only jackets. Anyways, they had members-only jackets. Members-only has gone through a resurgence, a renaissance, in recent years. For better or for worse. The members-only jackets themselves were a staple of 1980s fashion. Now, in their defense, they were really neat jackets. They're made out of nylon, and they had little windbreakers on them. They had a breast pocket on the left side, a little label that said members only. They zipped up. They had pockets for your hands, that kind of thing. They were very nice jackets, and they had an internal pocket as well, like for a pocketbook or a calculator or whatever have you, or a pack of cigarettes. Very cool. You know, they were very cool in the 1980s. An absolute staple of 1980s fashion. If you had a members-only jacket, you were cool. I had a members-only jacket when I was a kid. I will confess, I did have one. No shame in that. No shame in having one in the 1980s. It was part of the style, it was part of the era. No shame in it whatsoever. Now, when I see kids wearing members-only jackets now, I think it looks very silly. I think it looks very out of date, and it looks kind of ridiculous. And I was talking with a friend about this a while ago, and she said, I think if you didn't grow up during that time period, you don't have the right to wear the clothes, ironically. And I agree. I think it just looks ridiculous, that whole quote-unquote hipster style. It has nothing to do with the hipsters from the 50s. Has nothing to do with the Rat Pack whatsoever. It's just kids who were kind of raiding their parents' basement, or their older brother's basement, actually, their older brother's clothes, and re-wearing them, or recycling them. We're going to thrift stores and buying out-of-date clothing that was left over from the 80s, and wearing it. And they're doing it to kind of spoof and make fun of the 80s fashion. But in reality, they just look dumb dressed that way. And, so anyways, I thought, just for the hell of it, why don't I try on a members-only jacket? Just for the hell of it, you know, just to reminisce. So I was wearing jeans, I had on a dress shirt, and dress shoes, you know, whatever have you. And actually I was wearing slacks, because I was at work. And so I thought, why don't I just try on a members-only jacket? So I tried one on, and I found a black one. It matched the one I had exactly. And I put it on, and I zipped it up, and I looked at myself in the mirror. And I'd let my hair grow out a little bit. I've always had long hair. It's not been until recent years that I've actually cut my hair kind of short, or in some cases even buzzed it. But I let my hair grow out a little bit, and I was looking at myself in the mirror, and I saw how I looked with my hair, and in this members-only jacket, and with the pants I was wearing and the shoes that I was wearing, I looked exactly like I did when I was 8 years old. I kid you not. I looked like an 8-year-old boy, exactly how I looked when I was 8 years old, and I'm looking at myself and I'm thinking, God, I look just like I did when I was 8 years old. Alright, that's enough. And I unzipped the jacket, and I'd even buttoned up the little strap that goes around the collar. There's a name for that kind of collar, and I forget what it's called, but the jacket has a sort of priest collar, and then you have this vinyl strap that you button up to protect your neck. There's a name for that strap and a name for that kind of collar, and I forget what it's called. But I unbuttoned it, unzipped the jacket, I took it off. and I walked away from the mirror. And I hung the jacket up, you know, very carefully, you know, made it look as if nobody had worn it, and then just walked away. And I thought, okay, that was enough reminiscence for me. If this were 1985, that would look really cool on me, and I would have bought that jacket. And that jacket was $30. I don't know how much they cost in the 80s, probably that much. But I remember looking at it and thinking, if I were to wear that now, as an adult, I would look very silly. I would look very silly now. In 2011, actually it was 2010 when I tried that jacket on, and I thought, I would just look very silly. It would just look really silly on me now. All I needed to do was put on some Wayfarer sunglasses and some pony sneakers, and that would have been the end of it. I would have had an absolute 1980s recreation going on there. Maybe with some gel in my hair, too, to slick it back. And all I'd need is a boombox with some Duran Duran, and there you go. You know, but in all honesty, we all have reminiscence about time periods that we lived in. And in some cases, we romanticize the time periods that we didn't experience. Like in the 90s, I romanticized the 1960s very much. A time period that I didn't live in, but I liked the music from that time period and somewhat identified with it and would listen to it extensively as a teenager. Looking back on it now, that was maybe a bit silly, and maybe I didn't have a right to because I didn't experience that time period. But, you know, we all feel affinity for certain things. We feel affinity for different things that we may have not experienced, but wish that we had. And I've always been interested in medieval history, even though I'm not a big fantasy guy. You know, I'm very much interested in that historical time period, and I didn't live back then, and I don't think I would have enjoyed life back then. It was a very brutal time period. I don't romanticize that time period, but I just find it fascinating. I just find it interesting. You know, we all want the things that we can't have, and I think that's one of those things I just couldn't have, but feel an affinity for it, you know, have an interest in it. In the 1980s, maybe there are some people that romanticize that as well. You know, there are times where I'll get reminiscent for the music. I'll re-listen to, you know, Duran Duran and Tears for Fears and whatever else have you. Times when I'll listen to, or I'll watch music videos that I liked from the 1980s. In fact, I'll probably post a few of them in this week's show notes. There are movies that I liked in the 1980s that I still watch, some of which I mentioned in this countdown here, in this list. There are TV shows that I'll revisit, like The A-Team. You know, just for the hell of it, I'll revisit The A-Team. And much to my surprise, there was an episode where Lance Henriksen played a bad guy. So, you know, I'd get to rediscover trivia like that. And now, there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with reminiscing about things that you liked as a kid. There's nothing wrong with revisiting things that you cherished in your childhood, or as a teenager, or 20-something, whatever have you. The only danger is that some people get caught up in the past and cannot move on, and cannot accept anything new in their lives. And some people might say that that's why I'm so anti-remake, and that's not the reason why, because there are some remakes that are quite good. John Carpenter's remake of The Thing, which is actually based more closely on the original source material, the short story by John W. Campbell, and Cronenberg's remake of The Thing, I think is actually a vast improvement on Cronenberg's remake of The Fly is a vast improvement on the original, but to each their own. Not all remakes are bad, but a lot of remakes are. And what annoys me about a remake of Fright Night is that the original film is perfect the way it is. It's a good film. I could see them maybe doing a new Fright Night sequel or doing a movie in a similar vein, but to do a remake of it, it kind of insults the original, especially when the remake is so vastly different. Why bother remaking it at all? Why use the name? Why not just make a completely different film? So, that's a topic for another episode as well. You know, remakes and good ones and bad ones and so on. Chinstroker vs. Punter did a great episode about remakes and how not all remakes are bad, and they gave examples of good remakes and bad remakes, but a lot of them are bad. A lot of them are done in a bad spirit. You know, the danger of getting caught up in the past, you know, to get back to my original thread here, is that we can lose sight of what's going on now. We can lose sight of the present. You know, I know people that are so caught up in the past that they just can't move on, that every day of their lives they reminisce about it, and they're not able to live life in the now, or even look towards the future. And I think living in the past can be dangerous in a way. Reminiscing is fun. There's nothing wrong with reminiscing. But living in the past, dwelling on it, prevents you from growing up. And daydreaming about the future prevents you from seeing what's going on in the now and dealing with the now. And I spent a lot of time daydreaming as a kid, and I still do. And it's something I kind of curtail now because I want to live in the now and work on what's going today and not have to fantasize or worry so much about what's going on tomorrow. Because I have no idea what's going to happen tomorrow. So, in conclusion, reminiscence, not a bad thing, but like all things, needs to be kept in moderation, and there needs to be a balance. So, before I conclude this week's episode, I want to give a huge thank you to two bloggers, two gentlemen bloggers, Dr. Cyclops, great guy. I accepted his challenge of building a haunted house for Halloween. I'm keeping it hush-hush as to what the haunted house is going to be like. Or a haunted diorama, haunted landscape, whatever have you. Keeping it total hush-hush, but I've come up with something quite interesting that I'm pretty sure I can pull off. And I'm going to give it a try this October. I've been gathering materials for it for the past few months. And I think it's going to be something special. Second, oh, yes, I would like to thank him, first of all, for an award that he had given me, the Versatile Blogger Award. He'd given it to me some months ago, and I apologize for not mentioning it sooner. The Versatile Blogger Award is sort of internet meme blogger award, where bloggers honor other bloggers and podcasters and the like by giving them the Versatile Blogger Award, and one of the conditions of the award is that you select other podcasts and blogs and the like that you're a fan of, and then you refer people to those websites. And so there's seven of them that I shall refer people to, and not to cannibalize the award, but Dr. Cyclops is probably going to be one of them. He's a great guy, very funny, and his blog is always very interesting. Not a podcaster, in his case, but he is a blogger, and he posts a trivia competition every once in a while. A Name That Phil trivia. Name That Film, excuse me. Yeah, Name That Phil. Name That Film trivia competition. And we'll have stills of different films, and you have to figure out what films those stills belong to. And it's a ball buster, I'll be honest with you. It's a great trivia competition. Very difficult to do. You'll have one film that's easy, one that's medium, and one that's extremely hard. And I'm running neck and neck with another competitor named Jen, who herself does a very good website, which I will include in the Versatile Blogger Meme Award as well. And so far I'm 8-8. And if I don't know what something is, I'll just make up a fake title for it. One of these days I have to read out the fake titles I've made up. They're quite funny. So he had given me that award a few months ago. And Dr. Blood, of Dr. Blood's Video Vault, also has awarded me the Versatile Blogger Award. About a week ago, he awarded me the Versatile Blogger Award. So I've thanked both gentlemen, and I would like to thank them again for giving me that award. I'm surprised I won it twice. I'm surprised I won it at all, to be honest with you. So thank you very much. And winning it twice is just as nice. So I'm going to pass it along and nominate some people for it, or award it to some people, I should say. If not this week, then within the coming weeks, I'm going to be very selective and choose some people to send it out to. So thank you very much. I greatly appreciate it, both Dr. Blood and Dr. Cyclops. So I think that's going to be it for this week. Thank you all for listening. I thank you all very much. Again, this podcast is located at http blah 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 www.flypaperdungeon.blogspot.com. You can download me from there, or listen to me from there, or download me directly from archive.org. Just type in Flypaper Dungeon. But it's probably easiest just to go to my website, because I have a player embedded there, and I also have a link to download me embedded from there. Well, download the show, not me personally. And my email address is flypaperdungeon@gmail.com. So I thank you all for listening. I'm not certain what I'm going to do next week. I'm learning now that I shouldn't announce what I'm going to do next week, because sometimes I change my mind. Sometimes, due to work and other constraints, I don't get the chance to do a full episode or do the episode that I intended. So, anyways, I thank you all for listening very much, and I will talk to you next week. This is Johnny Zombie, over and out.